Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, August 30th, 2017. The father of the slain U.S. freelance journalist says his son died for a cause.
And he found it very refreshing when people would stand up for what they considered their human rights and the rights of their country.
And South Sudan government spokesman now says the government regrets the death of an American journalist.
As a government of South Sudan, we pass our condolences to the family, relatives and friends of Christopher Allen, who died in the course of his duty.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan government says it regrets the killing of an American freelance journalist on Saturday and sends its condolences to the family. Christopher Allen was killed by South Sudan government forces while embedded with rebel forces loyal to Riek Machar near the South Sudan-Uganda border. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Juba.
Information Minister and Government Spokesman Michael McWay denies the 28-year-old American journalist was targeted, saying Allen was one of the rebels.
16 rebels, including a white rebel, were killed. The identity of that white man is not known, but he was among those who attacked the garrison.
Today, McWay changed the narrative, saying Christopher Allen was killed in the crossfire as government troops fought to repulse the rebels. He also sounded a more conciliatory tone.
We, as a government of South Sudan, we pass our condolences to the family, relatives and friends of Christopher Allen, who died in the course of his duty.
On Monday, SPLN opposition deputy spokesman Colonel Lam Paul Gabriel told VOA Allen was armed with a camera only. McWay said, the fact that Allen died is regrettable.
We send our condolences to the family of Chris Allen for his untimely death. He's a very young man who should have continued to serve the humanity for long, but unfortunately, he met his fate in Kaya.
McWay was quick to say the government troops did not kill Allen intentionally.
The killing of Christopher Allen was not targeted as it is being reported by some sources, but when a fighting ensued between two fighting forces, then whoever is in front of you is a target, because even in the fighting, when we are shooting ourselves at a range of 50 or 100 meters, I will not be seeing that what you are carrying there is a camera.
McWay's latest statement contradicts what he told VOA in Monday's exclusive interview. In that interview, McWay denied flatly that Christopher Allen was a journalist.
He is not a freelance journalist, he is a rebel. So far, he attacked the town together with the rebels and he was killed in the line of the rebels.
McWay says Allen was not allowed to enter South Sudan because the government objected to his previous reporting.
Chris Allen had been one of the reporters who had been coming to South Sudan, but because of his hostile reports, the government decided to deny him entry into South Sudan. And as a result, he decided to go to the rebels and enter South Sudan the other way around.
Colonel Gabriel said on Monday that Allen entered South Sudan through Uganda. Around 20 other journalists were also denied entry into the country by South Sudan's media authority in May and June. McWay says, while the killing of Allen is regrettable, the international community should also condemn the attack on Kaya, which he says was carried out by rebels loyal to Riek Machar in an attempt to capture the town.
I would expect the special representative of the Secretary General to come up clearly and condemn the act of the rebels. I expect the European Union, the Troika, and the African Union and IGAD to come up in clear words and condemn this act of the rebels.
10 journalists have been killed in South Sudan since 2012. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
The mother of the slain journalist says her son believed it was important to look away from the worst humanity. Christopher's mother says at the age of 26, Allen had lived up to that belief, covering conflict in both South Sudan and Ukraine. Salim Solomon has more for VOA from Washington.
Freelance journalist Christopher Allen believed it was important to not look away from the worst of humanity, By the age of 26, he had lived up to this belief, covering conflict in Ukraine and South Sudan and sharing powerful stories with people around the world.
He chose to bear witness. He chose to look unflinchingly at what was painful and to find the humanity within it.
His mother, Joyce Carrigan, told VOA, on August 26, Alan was killed in the southern border town of Kaya, South Sudan, in a clash between government and rebel groups. During his studies in Europe, Alan was riveted by images of revolution in Ukraine and decided to travel there to cover the story. His mother says,
in the middle of that program, when the rest of his cohort was going off to the Greek islands, Chris chose to go to Ukraine. It was just post Maidan Square. And he said, I want to see history in the making. I don't want to read about history. So that was his draw to Ukraine.
Alan's work appeared in The Telegraph, the BBC, Mashable, and other outlets. In 2014, he was one of the first reporters to arrive at the crash site of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, which was shot down over Ukraine, killing 298 people. Later, as part of a documentary, he shared his thoughts on a carnage he saw that day in a wheat field.
You know, just being in Donetsk, being in eastern Ukraine, seeing all this death, you're conscious of how quickly a life can be taken, whether it's the person walking across the playground during shelling, or whether it's the people who fell 10,000 meters in a plane. You quickly become conscious, being here, being in the middle of this conflict, that life is a really fragile thing.
As they wait for the return of their son's body to the U.S., Alan's family is also preparing for a birth. His younger brother is expecting a baby in the coming weeks. While they celebrate a new life, the family is left grieving the son they say could have chosen a comfortable existence in academia, but instead was driven to tell stories of people seeking freedom in forgotten corners of the world. His father, John Alan, said,
and he found it very refreshing when people would stand up for what they considered their human rights and the rights of their country. And he was interested in what makes these folks tick, who were prepared to put themselves out, to sacrifice, to even make the ultimate sacrifice, which most of us don't dare to do.
Above all, they feel incredible sense of loss at a life cut short.
We are all really devastated by Chris's loss. He was such a big-hearted, big-spirited guy. It's really hard to imagine the world without him, our world. We have gotten a lot of response from people who knew him and said that truly this is a loss to the world.
Salem Solomon for VOA News, Washington, D.C.
The United States has donated more than 30 metric tons of high-energy biscuits to refugees in Uganda. The biscuits will benefit thousands of South Sudanese refugees who continue to flee violence at home. The U.S. plans to donate a total of 150 metric tons of high-energy food over the next few weeks. Simon Peter Apiku has more for VOA from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
U.S. Ambassador to Uganda, Deborah Malak, presented WFP Country Director Al-Khidr Dalum with 36 metric tons of high-energy biscuits during a ceremony today at the Food Agency's warehouse at Kisubi, near Uganda's Entebbe International Airport. Ambassador Malak says the shipment could not have arrived at a better time.
Our partner, the World Food Program, as you've heard, is about to face a pipeline break in this essential commodity. With the arrival of these biscuits, we've been able to help prevent that pipeline break.
Dalum says the 36 tons of biscuits plus another 114 tons expected to arrive in the next couple of weeks will cover 75% of WFP's needs for the rest of the year.
It will enable us to provide high-energy biscuits to nearly 380,000 refugees.
The UNHCR says as the fighting continues in South Sudan, hundreds of refugees from that country continue to flee into Uganda each day. Many have worked for days, even weeks, with little or no food. Ambassador Malak says the high-energy biscuits are specifically manufactured to help this kind of refugees.
These biscuits are a versatile food that can be used in emergency situations as well as for supplemental feeding for vulnerable populations. They are the very first assistance that the refugees receive when they cross the border.
Uganda hosts more than 1 million refugees from South Sudan. The UNHCR says it is struggling to assist them, along with some 300,000 refugees from other countries. So far, the UNHCR says it has received only 20% of the more than $670 million it needs to provide assistance to refugees in Uganda this year. Dalum called on the international community to do more to support refugees in Uganda.
WFP needs approximately 20 million per month to provide food assistance to refugees at Four Russians. The need for adequate, timely and predictable funding had never been greater.
Due to dwindling funds last year, the WFP cut in half the amount of food rations it gives to refugees who have been in Uganda for more than a year. Some refugees say they have gone for up to 2 months without receiving food rations. Malak assured UNHCR that the U.S. will continue to respond to the humanitarian needs of refugees in Uganda.
Since October of 2016, the U.S. government has already provided $187 million in humanitarian assistance to the overall refugee support here in Uganda, making us the largest single donor for Uganda in addressing the refugee influx.
The ambassador praised the efforts of the American transportation company United Parcel Service, or UPS, which offered to ship free of charge all 150 metric tons of biscuits to Uganda. The UPS representative in Uganda, Luke Angwenyi, says the company is proud to be associated with this humanitarian work.
UPS as a corporation is deeply committed to the health, welfare and dignity of refugees around the world.
Angwenyi encouraged other private sector corporations to do what they can to support desperate refugees.
UPS believes the private sector has a vital role to play in facing the growing refugee challenge.
The WFP also uses its Kisubi warehouse to run its operations for airdropping vegetable oil and other food items into parts of South Sudan inaccessible due to either impassable roads or insecurity. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Piku in Kampala.
A group from the disputed Abyei region says the government of Sudan and South Sudan have failed to resolve Abyei's final status, which is claimed by both countries. A group calling itself Abyei Lawyers Network for Final Status says it will talk to political leaders and other stakeholders in both countries to expedite resolution of the area's final status. Michael Atit has the story for VOA from Juba.
Moinluaka Lorkwol, who heads the newly established Abyei Lawyers Group, says the governments of Sudan and South Sudan, as well as the African Union, have neglected to acknowledge the plight of the Abyei people who continue to suffer because they have few basic services and little local infrastructure.
The increasing scale of the people's suffering and growing complexity of the crisis caused by neglect and failure to honor widely witnessed agreements and government commitments have resulted in rising demand for action.
The Abyei Protocol, which is part of the 2005 Comprehensive Peace Agreement that ended war between Southern Sudan and Khartoum government, gave the people living in the nine Ngok Dinka chiefdoms an opportunity to decide in a referendum whether they wanted to belong to South Sudan or Sudan. The referendum was supposed to take place on January 9, 2011, the same day the people of Southern Sudan voted to separate from the rest of the Sudan. But the governments of Sudan and South Sudan were unable to agree on who was eligible to vote. The referendum was not held in 2011 in part because South Sudan rejected the inclusion of the nomadic Mesoria Arab tribe in referendum. The Sudanese army, accompanied by armed Mesoria Arabs, attacked the area in 2012, forcing many civilians to flee their homes and seek refuge in what was the South Sudan's Warapi State and Wau Town. In October 2013, the Ngok Dinka people of Abyei conducted a unilateral referendum and voted overwhelmingly to join South Sudan. But neither government of Sudan nor South Sudan has recognized those results. Moinluak says the rights of Abyei people must be respected.
Our people have united with their fellow South Sudanese generations and positively engaged the world to support their legitimate goals. Eventually, Abyei was defined by the concerned parties, both in Abyei Protocol of 2005 and the Abyei Arbitration of 2009 as, I quote, the area of the nine Ngok Dinka kingdoms transferred to Kordofan in 1905, unquote.
Moinluak says, despite the presence of United Nations interim security forces in Abyei, referred to as UNISFOR forces, violence and instability remain rampant in the area. Akunan Ajuang, a Ngok Dinka traditional chief, says Abyei has been unstable since British colonialists transferred the area to Kordofan in what was then northern Sudan for what was hoped would be a smoother administration more than 100 years ago. Speaking in Arabic, Ajuang called on the communities in Abyei to unite and demand that their leaders resolve the area's final status.
We need to see stability in Abyei as other places. We need to forget our internal problems and unite as one people. As we've just started, we need to work and bring stability to our people. We don't want the history to blame us later on.
Speaking in Arabic, Abyei women's rights activist Nyan Kwech Ngor urged the lawyers group to educate grassroots communities in Abyei on the importance of resolving the area's final status.
The first thing you have to do is to carry out civic education on our constitution so that we know our rights. We really want you to market our case.
Abyei resident Moinluak Agwe Rao says the issue has taken a long time to resolve because of all the legal aspects involved. Speaking in Arabic, Aguer says he hopes pressure from the lawyers group will focus international attention on Abyei.
I think this group is important because they will give more informed views to those who are following up the case and the final status could be reached.
Deng Byong, South Sudan's chief negotiator on the final status of Abyei, says the issue is now in the hands of the African Union.
The AU Peace and Security Council, in its 529 sitting, that was on 31st July 2015, adopted a resolution by which they refer the matter of Abyei to the AU chairperson. And now the matter is with the AU chairperson.
South Sudan's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Deng Alor, says his government did not forget about Abyei, saying it is working to address the matter with the African Union and the UN Security Council.
We have a resilient and a strong people. So don't get broken. We are going to win this case. And we will win it soon. What we need is advocacy, what you people have started. What we need is a strong position by the government of South Sudan, which we have developed and which we are trying now to address.
On May 15 this year, the UN Security Council extended UNISFOR's mandate until November 15. The Council also demanded that Sudan and South Sudan urgently begin to form the Abyei Area Administration and Council. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at an online auction for rhino horns in South Africa. That story is coming up next.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? people speak out on important questions. The question today:
are you concerned about global warming?
Not much. As much as we talk about it, I don't see much. This thing, global warming, I don't see its impact, personally. That's my personal opinion. So I'm not concerned about it.
Yeah, I'm concerned because when we stay in hot places, we could not be settled at all. So what we can do is to advise people not to deforestate the land. At least we should advise them to reforestate. Yeah.
Yes, I am, because I know that it will in the end spoil our environment and also affect our health. Yeah, our health will be damaged because of all this that we keep doing to the environment.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. South Africa's first online auction of rhino horn ends Friday, and thousands of bidders have reportedly shown interest. The auction is the product of a long years of legal battle that saw the country's largest private rhino breeders granted a permit to sell his stock. However, public debate on the issue continues. Tuso Khumalo reports for VOA from Johannesburg.
The three-day online auction was the first of its kind since South Africa banned the domestic trade in rhino horn in 2009. Hundreds of horns weighing 500 kilograms were for sale. The breeder told VOA the rhinos were tranquilized before their horns were harvested. Bidders were required to put down about $7,000 as a deposit to participate in the auction. Environmental groups have reacted angrily. Joe Shaw is the Rhino Program Manager at the World Wildlife Fund.
As WWF, we're concerned that the online auction is proceeding despite calls from all sides of the country. We advise the reinstatement of a domestic moratorium, at least until all the necessary control mechanisms identified by the Committee of Inquiry into International Trade have been instated.
But the rhino breeder selling his stock, John Hume, argues that the complete domestic ban had little impact. South Africa is home to 80% of the world's remaining rhinos, but according to government statistics, the country loses rhinos to poachers eager to traffic the horns to Asian countries, where they are believed to be able to treat various ailments despite lack of scientific backing. Hume says proceeds from the 264 horns in the online auction will help cover the $170,000 he says he spends each month to protect the head of rhino on his land.
If I don't sell rhino horn, in 10 years' time, my 1,535 rhinos out there are all going to be dead.
Hume successfully challenged the domestic ban in court in 2015. In April of this year, Parliament passed a new law following the court order to allow limited domestic trade in rhino horn. Hume returned to the courts earlier this month to compel the Department of Environmental Affairs to issue him a permit for the auction. Buyers at the online auction must agree that the horn will remain in South Africa after purchase. However, World Wildlife Fund, Shaw, and other animal rights activists argue that the government cannot ensure that the sold horns do not find their way to China or Vietnam, where a kilogram can fetch up to $60,000 on the black market.
We're worried about the capacity of enforcement officials to manage this legal trade on top of all those existing challenges relating to poaching and illicit trafficking of horn, as well as the potential risks to our wild populations should horn laundering happen through these channels.
International trade in rhino horn has been banned since 1977. Tuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Still in Southern Africa, there were dual demonstrations in Zimbabwe's capital today for and against First Lady Grace Mugabe. Sebastian Mwofu reports for VOA from Harare.
Members of the ruling ZANU-PF party marched in Harare chanting songs to show support for First Lady Grace Mugabe. They held placards written, "Gabriela Angels is not an angel." Angels is the South African model who accused Mugabe of assaulting her with an electrical cord 2 weeks ago at a Johannesburg hotel. The first lady was expected at the march, but senior ZANU-PF official Mandita Wepi Chimene said she had other commitments.
Chinu chaka kosha.
Chimene says, we cannot afford her to sleep outside her home. We have come here for our father and our mother, referring to longtime President Robert Mugabe and his wife. Chimene says, there's no way we are going to respect our father and ignore our mother. That statement is an apparent reference to ongoing rivalry within the ZANU-PF. One faction supports Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa to succeed Robert Mugabe, while another is backing Grace Mugabe to succeed her husband, who has ruled Zimbabwe since 1980. The First Lady has not spoken publicly since she returned from South Africa. Meanwhile, in South Africa, Angels has filed a court challenge to Grace Mugabe's diplomatic immunity. She had traveled to South Africa for medical treatment, not official business. On Wednesday, as the ruling ZANU-PF party merged, a coalition of Zimbabwean opposition parties rallied outside the South African embassy in Harare to protest Pretoria's handling of the alleged assault case. Opposition activist Linda Masarira.
Granting her immunity, saying political leaders can go anywhere in the world and assault people and get away with it because they've got diplomatic immunity. It depicts a negative image on all Zimbabweans.
South Africa's main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, last week filed papers with the nation's constitutional court seeking the court to reject the decision to grant diplomatic immunity to Mugabe. In a statement, the party said the move was, quote, wholly without legal merit and should thus be declared unconstitutional and invalid, unquote. No hearing date has been set for the case, but it could further strain Harare-Pretoria relations. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Take My Love, It's Free by superstar Yvonne Chaka Chaka. We've been listening to Yvonne Chaka Chaka with the song My Love Is Free. Remember, these are not my words. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. We'd like to hear what you think about our show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Our Facebook page is South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.